This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My next guest today is the poet Nikki Finney. Her work reckons with what it means to be a woman and Black in America and in the South, in the past and today. Her most recent collection is called Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. As the title suggests, it's a collection of poems written for occasions, as well as prose and ephemera that collectively tell part of her life story. In the introduction to the book, she writes, "I had not heard about the history of the occasional poem when I began writing them, and I did not share the hesitation of poets to answer such a call. I think of poetry as good devotional work." Finney's work has earned her accolades, including the National Book Award for Poetry in 2011 for another collection called Head Off and Split. Her acceptance speech for that award was itself a poem, and certainly poetic. Let's listen to an excerpt.
We begin with history, the slave codes of South Carolina, 1739. A fine of $100 and 6 months in prison will be imposed for anyone found teaching a slave to read or write, and death is the penalty for circulating any incendiary literature. The ones who longed to read and write but were forbidden, who lost hands and feet, were killed by laws written by men who believed they owned other men. Words devoted to quelling freedom, insurgency, imagination, all hope. What about the possibility of one day making a poem? The king's mouth and the queen's tongue, arranged to perfection on the most beautiful paper, sealed with wax and palmetto tree sap, determined to control what can never be controlled, the will of the human heart to speak its own mind.
Finney is the John H. Bennett, Jr. Endowed Professor of Creative Writing and Southern Letters at the University of South Carolina. I spoke with her in studio last April when she was in Illinois for a series of events at the U of I Urbana-Champaign, sponsored by the school's Humanities Research Institute. Nikki Finney, welcome to The 21st Show.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's great to be here.
I want to begin by asking you about across the country, we see state legislatures and school boards depriving students of prose that tells true stories of our history. What role do you see for poetry in making sure those stories are known?
This is a really important question, and it's really important to me as a poet who goes into communities, goes into schools, talks one-on-one with young people, older people, people who love poetry, storytelling, the truth, and are stunned at what is coming through the pipeline right now about the banning of books, the banning of information, the banning of truth. Poetry and the arts have always been at that intersection, historically, in my opinion. And the poets are always the one to sort of take out their beautiful hammer off their tool belt and chip away at this ridiculousness and talk about how much we need this information as human beings, how much we need to be in conversation about the things that potentially make us uncomfortable, potentially make us wonder why we didn't know this when we were growing up in this country. And so art has always been the wedge and the bloom and the rose, if you will, to our being, looking each other in the eye and having those hard conversations and making it clear that we have to fight for that information. We have to fight for those books. If not, we're going to live in a very imbalanced world.
As a poet who often writes about our history, how does that help us? How does history help us understand contemporary issues, what we're going through now?
Well, if you don't know the history that you come from, or if you haven't been given all of the history that you need to get a full picture, then potentially you can make some of the same ridiculous mistakes that we made 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and even farther back than that. So why not use history as a lens, as a telephoto lens, as a wide angle lens? I love photography, if you can hear that in my speech patterns. But why not use that brilliant glass that we have there so that we don't have to go backwards before we go forwards, which is what I feel like we're kind of in the middle of right now.
I want to ask you to read a poem for us, and I should tell listeners, I'm sorry, I did not give you proper warning for this,
you
so
did
I
not.
Thank you. I thank you for rolling with it. If you want to choose, that's fine, or I also can offer a suggestion. You have a book I've marked there, A New Day Dawns, I thought.
Yes, I was asked by the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, the day before the Confederate flag was coming down, if I could write something for the occasion. And I stayed up all night to pen this poem called A New Day Dawns. On the occasion of the Confederate flag falling in South Carolina, July 10, 2015. It is the pearl blue peep of day. All night the palmetto sky was seized with the aurora and alchemy of the remarkable. A blazing canopy of newly minted light fluttered in while we slept. We are not free to go on as if nothing happened yesterday, not free to cheer as if all our prayers have finally been answered today. We are free only to search the yonder of each other's faces as we pass by, tip our hat, hold a door ajar, asking silently, who are we now? Blood spilled in battle is two-headed. Horror and sweet revelation. Let us put the cannons of our eyes away forever. Our one and only civil war is done. Let us tilt, rotate, strut on. If we the living do not give our future the same honor as the sacred dead of then and now, we lose everything. The gardenia air feels lighter on this new day, guided now by iridescent fireflies, those atom-like creatures of our hot summer nights now begging us to team up and search with them for that which brightens every darkness. Soon, it will be just us, again, alone, beneath the swirling indigo sky of South Carolina, alone and working on the answer to our great day's question. Who are we now? What new human cosmos can be made of this tempest of tears, this upland of inconsolable jubilation? In all our lifetimes, finally, this towering, undulating moment is here.
We're listening to my conversation with the poet Nikki Finney, recorded last April when she was in Illinois for a series of events at the U of I. Now begging us to team up and search with them for that which brightens every darkness. It strikes me that that poem was written in 2015, at a period where we thought we were making some forward progress in this country. How do you reckon with that time and what has happened in the years since?
Well, I reckon with that time and now in the whole, again, the chronology of American history. This is not new, what we're in. This is old stuff. And this is what one of the things I was telling an audience yesterday of young people. If you don't know that history, if you're not curious about how we got here, then you really don't understand why we are here. And there are people in strategic places who don't want us to be better than we are. That alarms me. There are people in strategic places who would put laws into place, who would like to keep everything as it is. That alarms me as a poet and as a human being. So one of the things I love about the Humanities Institute here is how it brings so many different people across the board to talk about what it means to be a citizen of humankind now, and to know that history so that the young folks who are in school, who are studying engineering and the arts and all of those wonderful subjects, can also incorporate the fact that we are slowly being divided even more so by social media, by lies, by a narrow-minded thinking about history. And it doesn't have to be that at all, because we are one people. We are humankind. So I love the humanities for that fact. I love history because as a poet, as James Baldwin taught me, the poet always knows first. And he didn't say that like it was some competition, but he meant that my job is to not look away from the difficult subjects that we have before us. And it is also my job to incorporate some beauty into those difficult situations. And that's what leads to the conversations that we've been having here in Urbana-Champaign this week. And it leads to those conversations leaving Urbana-Champaign and going across the border to other places, to other people who aren't just poets, but who are as furious as I am about how we keep taking two steps backwards before we take one step forward.
Your writing is suffused with this, it strikes me as an immense pride in the intellectual and freedom drive of Black Americans throughout our history. It's almost like a sort of patriotism.
Mm.
How were those seeds planted in your life?
Those seeds were planted by my amazing mother and father, who, my father's from Virginia, my mom's from South Carolina, both farming people, kids of farmers. This morning I took a walk across the campus and loved the sky. That there's nothing like the sky here. It's the plains, you know, open up. But when I was growing up on their farms, they were talking about self-sufficiency. They were talking about the history of their grandparents. They were talking about what it took for my grandfather to purchase a farm at the turn of the century. And those kinds of things instill in you a certain pride in who you are, your legacy, familial legacy, but also the legacy of the intellect, the legacy of the heart. I remember my grandfather getting up every morning at 4 o'clock, going out into the fields to do what he did, and my grandmother going in the chicken coop to get the eggs and fix us, you know, a breakfast. And I also remember them saying to me, never sell this land, because this land took so much to get in the first place and then passing it on to us. So not only was the geography of the farm and the land passed on to me, but the blood, sweat, and tears that went into that land, all the things they didn't want to talk about, the violence, the Ku Klux Klan that came down the road one day to scare my mother as a girl, all those things, as a poet, I remember, and I feel like it's my responsibility when we talk about the occasional poem, not just the occasion where we're all dressed up and going, getting ready to go to something that, you know, is polished and pearled, but the occasion of human life. And I want to remember those sacrifices that my family made on both sides of the family so that I could be a poet in the world and so that I could stand before any audience and let them see who I am and know that that truth has to do with me and my DNA, but it has more to do with humankind.
We have about 3 minutes until we need to take a break. You've written about how your mom was always clipping out newspaper articles yes. And there wasn't a book on Black history that came available that they didn't buy. Your father was a lawyer
right. And
judge,
yes.
Chief Justice, actually.
The first African-American Chief Justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court.
Since Reconstruction.
Since Reconstruction.
Since Reconstruction.
Yes, very proud of him.
How, when you were a child, how aware were you of that, and your father represented this group called the Friendship Nine?
Yes, very modest man. I wasn't aware of it hardly at all, but I was aware that when the phone rang, my father would get his hat and coat and leave the house and go and get young college students out of jail who had sat at the Cress lunch counter because they wanted to have a cheeseburger and a milkshake. And he would come back home, and I was his only girl. I was his only daughter, and we had an amazing relationship. His name for me was Love Child, and that's how the name came on the book. But his sense of justice, he was recruited to the town that we grew up in, like these days a basketball player would be recruited to come and play for, you know, the University of Illinois, because at that time in 1960, they needed young whippersnapper lawyers right out of law school to come and defend those college students. And there was my dad raising his hand because he himself, in the same way that I felt a deep responsibility for being able to have to go to college and to go to law school and to be, you know, in this position to get these young people who just wanted a fair and just world out of jail. And so I was a kid, but he made me understand that art and justice can go hand in hand. He wanted me to go to law school, and I think I broke his heart because I didn't. But once he heard my work, and once I, you know, started really writing with that seriousness, I remember he came to me and he said, okay, you might have made the right choice.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. And your brothers are lawyers.
Both knucklehead brothers are lawyers. One is a solicitor. One is defense lawyer. And so all of that talk about law school at the dinner table, you know, made it to their ears, but it did not make it to my ears.
Let me reintroduce my guest. It's the poet Nikki Finney. She is a professor of creative writing and Southern Letters at the University of South Carolina. She is a National Book Award winner for her collection Head Off and Split. That was in 2011. More recently, she published Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. I spoke with her last April when she was in Central Illinois for a series of events sponsored by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's Humanities Research Institute. We're going to continue our conversation with Nikki Finney when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with the poet Nikki Finney. She is the author most recently of Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry, a collection of poems for occasions. She's also a professor of creative writing and Southern Letters at the University of South Carolina. I spoke with her in April last year when she was in Illinois for a series of events sponsored by the U of I Urbana-Champaign's Humanities Research Institute.
So I mentioned that professor of creative writing in Southern Letters. You know, nobody really talks about Northern Letters in the way they do Southern Letters. But I wonder, how have you seen what counts as Southern Letters change since you were a college student?
I think the window is wider. You know, it's open. There was the canon, if you will, that I grew up.
Faulkner,
yeah, right. You know, and those wonderful writers. The window has been jimmied up a little bit higher to allow Ernest Gaines to come into that room, and others, and younger writers. Crystal Wilkinson from Kentucky, who is a friend of mine, is a wonderful writer of fiction. And so that window has to, in the same way we're talking about books being banned and students not knowing there is a wider world. Those young people went to school, got their PhDs, and came back to schools, land-grant institutions, and fought for the canon to look a little differently. And because of that now, we have different. It has a different hue. It has a different sound. It has different a different language to it, and that shows young students who are studying fiction and other kinds of literature that there is not one literature, but there is a human literature. They're studying literature from all over the world, you know, and that's important because that reflects on every single community in this country.
I have read in my life quite a lot of prose about Condoleezza Rice. But I must say, I don't think I'd read any poetry about Condoleezza Rice until I encountered your work. So what drew you to Condoleezza Rice?
That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked that. Because
and maybe for younger listeners, we should even explain who Condoleezza Rice is.
Right. The thing that I should say first is I am interested in more than the 18 seconds that CNN or other news agencies give to people who are always, you know, in our face. Mm. I did the same thing with Rosa Parks in Head Off and Split in the same book. And I'm always looking for the research about their humankind, their humanity. What don't I know about them that would be interesting for a poem, right? Mm. So as the Secretary of State in, I don't know the year,
late Bush administration.
Right. Yeah. Here was this black woman walking through the White House with incredible power and incredible a place at the table. And so I was wondering, what was the rest of her life like? And so I did this research. It took me months, read the bio, read the, you know, all of those biography of her and other kinds of things. And I discovered these amazing things about her, that she was a pianist, that she got up at 4 o'clock and worked out. And all of these things made their way into a series of a suite of poems that I wrote about her. People always ask me, did I ever hear from Condoleezza Rice after these poems were published? And I said modestly, no, she didn't write in, but that's okay. Maybe she saw them. I don't know.
Well, and yet one part of her backstory, she described her as the fifth little girl of Birmingham.
She was born in Birmingham and raised. And I say that metaphorically because I feel like even though four little black girls were killed that day when the bombs went off in that church,
by the Klan,
yeah. And I feel like thousands were affected in a different kind of way. And even in that moment, we talk about the four that were killed, but there were 12 that were maimed. And we don't know their names like we know the four, and we don't know what happened to them in that same kind of way. So I say that Condoleezza Rice and her family left Birmingham, right after that incident or soon after that incident. And I feel like she, too, had to have been affected by what happened on that Sunday morning.
Indeed, she talked about being friends and playing dolls with the girls.
Yeah. Yes.
So can I ask you to read Concerto No. 7 from this suite?
Sure. Concerto No. 7, Condoleezza working out at the Watergate. Condoleezza rises at 4, stepping on the treadmill. Her long fingers brace the two slim handles of accommodating steel. She steadies her sleepy legs for the long day ahead. She doesn't get very far. Her knees buckle, wanting back last night's dream. Dream number 9, where she is 15 and leaning forward from the bench, playing Mozart's piano concerto in D minor alone, before the gawking, disbelieving, applauding crowd. Not dream number 2, where she is 9 and not in the church that explodes into dust, the heart pine floor giving way beneath her friend Denise, rocketing her up into the air like a jack-in-the-box of a black girl wrapped in a Dixie cross. She ups the speed on the treadmill, remembering she has to be 3 times as good. Don't mix up your dreams, Condi. She runs faster, back to the right, finally hitting her stride. Mozart returns to her side. She is 15 again, all smiles and relocated to the peaks of the Rocky Mountains, where she and the Steinway are the only black people in the room. You can only do that in poetry, Brian.
Absolutely.
Make the piano a black person.
Yeah.
The metaphor of that. That's why I love poetry. It's like the permission to do that is just it's magical for me.
Continue the musical metaphors, the overtones, right? Later you write in another in this cycle, in the future, when she plays
yes.
Secretary of State on the world stage, the Black Keys will always be a stretch.
You got to use that metaphor. You can't just let it go. You got to stretch it through the other poems, or you know why, or why use it in the first place. But
yeah.
The other factoid of this is that here was this Black woman Secretary of State living at the Watergate. That was where her apartment was. So as a poet and as a poet who loves research, you can't let that go.
No. We have about 7 minutes left in our time together today. I also want to ask you about mentorship, both your mentors, who you so profoundly thanked at the National Book Awards speech. Which
you made
is,
me cry when you played that again. I haven't heard it for a long time because it makes me a little teary.
People should seek out the YouTube video. It's quite moving. But you also now, I mean now, for many years you have taught college students. I guess my question for you about this is, have you finished reading every book in the library?
No, I have not. This was a question put to me as a 20-year-old sitting on a 19-year-old sitting on the Talladega College walls by my esteemed and best professor, who made her point well, you know, was well taken, that life is short, time is very short, and you need to get busy. If you really want to do this with your life, you need to be serious. You need to be committed. And I'm still going into the beautiful library, the wondrous library, where I first discovered books in that arena. And I'm still pulling things off the shelf. I'm still curious. I'm still a mad reader of everything I can put my hands on. And I really want my students to follow suit. Because I feel like my family was from a small town. We had one car. I didn't get on a plane until later in my life. But books allowed me to travel. Books allowed me to know that the world was really small and connected. And I wanted to know that because I wasn't sure I would ever get on a plane and go to those places. And what I want my students to know is how the world will open their arms to them when they are ready to go and do that kind of traveling, and how books can take them there. And so I am still a gray-haired bookworm now, even though I've been teaching for about 35 years in the academy, and also teaching in the community, and teaching every time someone will sit down with me and talk about poetry or art or something going on, because I feel like teaching can happen on many, many levels.
Feel it right now?
Yeah, good. Good. Sorry.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
One of the best pieces of advice I ever got, and the type of writing I do, which is journalism, was read before you write. What advice do you give to young people who want to follow you into the world of poetry?
I tell them that they have two brains. One is in their noggin, in their head, and the other is in their belly. And they'd have to find the paths and the rivers that take information from their brains to their bellies. Because sometimes you want to write something and somebody will tell you, well, that's not going to sell. That's not going to go over so well. Mm. But you, your belly is telling you, you need to write this. This needs to come from you, and it needs to come from you in a certain kind of way. And so my journey as a writer is to figure out all those tributaries that have fed my work for all of these years. And I want them to figure out, because they've got to find them. They've got to get in that little life raft or that boat, and they've got to travel down that river from one port to the other port. Because that, in the between that, is where the really rich, loamy soil is waiting on them.
In the time we have remaining, I often wonder about... I don't really like that phrase, guilty pleasures. So without guilt, is there a poet whose work you admire and appreciate that would maybe surprise people who are your readers, your fans? I don't know, maybe you're a big Poetry of John Updike fan or something like that.
Well, you know, I don't know about surprise, but I do know that I spent yesterday morning in the rare book room at UI in the papers of Gwendolyn Brooks of Chicago, and I will never be the same. because though Miss Brooks was a North Star for me as a younger poet, I have never been around her work. I've never touched her notebooks like my notebooks and been up and to see that we are related in the fact that we are two Black girls who love to scribble things down. Everything from what we eat to what we feel to what we see to the clouds to from an urban setting to a rural setting like I grew up in. I will never forget this trip because of that morning yesterday that I spent with those amazing archivists who love and protect her work. And that is right here on this, on these sacred grounds. So I don't know. I might have to get a second citizenship for Urbana-Champaign after I leave South Carolina.
I think you will be welcome back anytime. Nikki Finney, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you, Brian.
Nikki Finney is a poet and the author most recently of the collection Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. She won a National Book Award in 2011 for a collection called Head Off and Split. She was in Urbana, Illinois last April for a series of events sponsored by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's Humanities Research Institute, which is when I spoke with her. This is our final holiday encore broadcast. We'll be back with live programs beginning tomorrow with our Friday local and political news roundups. Then coming up on Monday of next week, an entire week of special programming on the fentanyl crisis in America. What is fentanyl? How did it get into our country? And how did it infect so many other drugs that are somewhat, at least, less harmful than fentanyl? We'll talk about addiction. We'll talk about the politics of fentanyl and what other places are doing to try to address this crisis. That's all coming up next week on The 21st Show. Our program is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. You can get a podcast of this program by visiting our website, 21stshow.org, or just look us up wherever you listen, Apple, Spotify, or any other fine podcast apps. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.